Well, good morning. Welcome. I'm Rodney Hobson, a faculty member at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, professor in the Evaluation in the Queries Division, interim director of CREA. Really excited to have some colleagues here today talking about some really critical issues. If you didn't get an opportunity to hear AERA, I was discussing for a roundtable, disruption, interruption, and change. It's not enough. What we need is sabotage, critical participatory inquiry as sabotage in and of the academy. And so I'm going to open up by having our colleagues introduce themselves and their key ideas and then come back around with questions. Off to you, Melissa.
I'm Melissa Haber-Ezer. I recently completed my PhD at George Mason University in the International Education Program. And our first paper in the panel was a collaborative counter-storytelling piece that I co-authored with Megan, Cheryl, and Elizabeth, which examined an incident that occurred within our ongoing YPAR project, or Youth Participatory Action Research Project. And this incident, and then our conversations about it after the fact, pushed us to consider our power relations within the collective, and then especially around race and gender, and then our relationships or interactions with the host institutions within which we're doing this critical participatory work.
Great, thanks, Melissa. My name is Giovanni Dazzo. I'm a doctoral candidate in research methodology at George Mason University. And my article was titled Small Acts of Sabotage, Unraveling Expertise to Push for Restorative Forms of Inquiry. And in this paper, I've been reflecting on my personal background and how I needed to bring this into my own methodological work. And as a doctoral candidate specializing in critical methodology, I needed to acknowledge my identity as a child of Sicilian immigrants, you know, being raised in a small rural California town into a family of farmers and laborers. But for example, in farming communities, when we see smoke billowing from an open field of crops, this isn't necessarily a sign of danger, but one of renewal, of coordinated and careful sabotage. And when done carefully, this practice called slash and burn or slash and cover has been ecologically sustainable for millennia. So I started to think about qualitative research in this way. What type of land needs to be cleared, burned, and left uncultivated for some time? And reflecting on which methodological processes have been around for so long that they're worth burning down. So in this paper, I discuss three areas. How often are we inspired by the words of our co-researchers and community members, so much so that they should be cited alongside the greats who have thousands of citations, but where we relegate their words to the findings sections of our papers. Second, I started questioning my parsimonious citation practices. So in some cases, I simply use terms like double consciousness and simply include parentheticals for W.E.B. Du Bois in our usual APA and Chicago styles. But it's almost an erasure, a divestment of knowledge divorced from the historical, contextual, political, and racial. So this small act of sabotage has required me to credit and balance the words of others at the expense of my own. And last, I've begun to explore what I call known methods, or those that community members and I already use in our daily lives. So when I talk about these known methods, it's not about erasing our knowledge as researchers, but more about acting in humility to unlearn our methods through the act of recognizing community expertise. So I don't simply decenter my experience or romanticize community members' traditional knowledge, which is another issue in and of itself, but recenter both, acknowledging each as residing in expertise.
Thank you, Giovanni. I'm looking forward to reading your work. Hello, I'm Cheryl Hassel-Goodman. I'm a PhD candidate in the higher education program with a focus in women and gender studies and social justice. So my paper is a self-study as a result of a Black feminist critical participatory action research project in which a group of 22 undergraduate and graduate women of the African diaspora. And when I say African diaspora, we represent Black, African-American, African, Afro-Caribbean, Afro-Cuban, and Afro-Latina women operate as a research collective. Throughout this manuscript, I explored an endarkened feminist epistemological approach to critical participatory action research as an act of sabotage to radically center Black women's knowledge as legitimate. I document the ways in which I navigated and negotiated my ethical commitments and obligations to the research collective through critical events analysis. Along the way, I realized that my voice around knowledge shifted and my orientation in the classroom was disrupted. I look at three incidents around my experiences in the classroom throughout the article. Using the researcher journal as data and critical events analysis as a framework, I explore the following questions. One, how does a first generation woman of the African diaspora researcher come to know? Two, what does it mean for a Black woman's knowledge to be interpreted as legitimate? And three, how is research an act of self-sabotage? As a result of this study, I found that in darkened feminist epistemological approach to participatory action research is critical to undo the erasure of Black women's knowledge in the academy. Exposing the nature of white supremacy that maintains normative confines within the academy is to understand the challenges associated with other cultural norms and standards, specifically Black women, to be seen as legitimate.
All right, thank you, Sherelle. My name is Elizabeth Chan. I'm an associate professor at Northern Virginia Community College and also a PhD candidate in multilingual, multicultural education at George Mason University. And I worked also on the paper together with Sherelle and Melissa and Megan that Melissa so very well outlined at the beginning.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Hello, my name is Sasha Reed, and I am a PhD candidate at George Mason studying special education and qualitative research methods with special interest in intellectual and developmental disabilities, inclusion, and accessible and equitable research opportunities. I'm in the process of completing a three-paper dissertation, which is aimed at understanding the concept of inclusion at the post-secondary level from young adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities through a critical participatory inquiry project. My panel paper was titled Sabotaging Method, The Tensions of Accepting Responsibility. And I'm drawing particularly from paper three, which documents the process of how I approach, navigate, and I'm reconciling my researcher responsibilities and commitments to my researcher group during the entire traditional research cycle process. So question, design and approach, data collection, data analysis, and deciding on next steps. And I'm really focusing on where and how I'm yielding my position of power to disrupt that traditional cycle and where I can design or simply leave room for organic participation to occur with participants with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Throughout, I'm grappling with the following questions which guide the paper from the AERA panel. What is recognized as research in my field being special education and disabilities? And how am I navigating the difference between a method and a way of inquiry? Two, who is this research for? And three, how is my power and positionality as a person who does not identify as having disability tied up in this tension of responsibility? My responsibility to produce knowledge that's deemed academically significant, as well as my responsibility to meaningfully include a commonly forgotten population in the research arena.
Thanks, Sasha. My name is Megan Call Cummings. I'm an assistant professor of research methods at George Mason University, where we're all from in one way or another. So I specialize in participatory, feminist, and critical qualitative methodologies. The paper I wrote for this panel is called Sabotaging Significance, A Call for Less Research and More Organizing. The paper is kind of a description of my journey of sort of critical reflexivity and kind of messy and fluid processes of both and sometimes simultaneous adaptation to and also rejection of the status quo within academia. So over the course of the last 7 years, I've sort of shifted professional positions from doctoral student to university faculty member, and I've kind of flipped back and forth often between a research trajectory that I would consider to be kind of like edgy and anti-racist, but still within the bounds, like the safety bounds of being deemed acceptable. And then research that kind of tries to give the middle finger to academia, to, you know, my university, even my future tenure committee, right? It's like, whatever, I'm gonna do what I want. If I get tenure, it is what it is, right? So I kind of flip between those two often. So the paper follows this messy journey, offering vignettes to illustrate this kind of difficult process of really completely altering the way academia understands and applies the intertwined white supremacist concepts of rigor, validity, trustworthiness, and of course, significance. So these concepts and practices, I argue in the paper, are applied routinely and often invisibly as tools of domination and control, as is much that calls itself research. So what I argue in the end is that what we need, just like Eve Tuck has said, in this moment is less research and more organizing. And I wonder, you know, how would we measure the significance of such a move? Back to you, Rodney.
Awesome. Well, let's go back to you actually, Megan, because I'm familiar with your work, and this panel seems to be an offshoot of some other work that you've been doing, been asking, bringing in other saboteurs and other critical participants in the space. So what led us to this particular work at AURA and this presentation? And tell us a little bit more, if you don't mind.
Thanks, Rodney. I appreciate that. So yeah, we were all part of a class last summer, the summer of 2020. I had planned to facilitate a special topics class on decolonizing methodologies, really because several students, you know, like the ones here and others, had kind of come to me and said this is something that they needed. So I put together a syllabus during the spring semester, knew it would be online because of COVID. And then, you know, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was like less than a week before the class actually started that George Floyd was murdered by police officers, and protests for racial justice erupted across the US and the world. So that not only became, I mean, the sense of a backdrop really doesn't do it justice in terms of how it affected that class. It was like this simultaneous experience. We were all living in different ways because of our different identities and connections to racial injustice and things like that. And so it became, these class discussions were like rich and messy and raw with vulnerability and anger and resentment of academia and our places within this structure that's so often thick with injustice and inequity, but simultaneously has so many people working for justice and equity. And it was actually one of Giovanni's posts, I think, along with some of Eve Tuck's work that we read together, I believe, that suggested the idea of sabotage, right? The idea that what's needed now is, as Giovanni said, burn the place down or start little fires everywhere, right? What's needed now is not more research, right? Is not more research into what's wrong or who the problems are, but it's about organizing. It's about scholars becoming activists and taking responsibility and ownership of these processes. So we talked a lot about being tired of academia or the way things are in higher ed, the status quo. And so that's kind of what led us to the idea of this panel.
Yeah. That's quite helpful. Maybe I'll just pick on you, Giovanni, as well, to talk a bit about both the theoretical frameworks that have inspired this work around saboteur. I mean, you don't have resistant. You don't use like resistant or resistor. And then, I mean, tell us more about what it is for you to bring those frameworks. Slash and burn from the farming, Italian migrant. Please make the connections.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first for me, looking at conceptual and theoretical frameworks I've been using more recently, I have put aside the academic literature. I have spoken with my grandfather, and spoken to my parents. And first and foremost, I have also spoken to community members that I work alongside in Guatemala, who are Cachical Maya farmers, laborers, community members. And so when I started to think about theoretical frameworks and what it means to theorize, I stepped away from the traditional scholars because I felt this needed to be my first small act of sabotage in unraveling what I was socialized to think was expertise. So as now, as I construct conceptual frameworks or theoretical frameworks for my own dissertation and various articles, I actually start with the words of community members and cite them alongside the greats, including Paulo Freire, bell hooks, Martin Baro, W.E.B. Du Bois. But second, I've been engaging more and more with sociological theory and communication studies since I typically conduct applied research and program evaluation on human rights and justice initiatives. So Darren Barney's work on sabotage and the politics of withdrawal have been pivotal for me as it provides this theoretical grounding in critical theory and historical examples of sabotage, and how we don't really talk about sabotage when we engage in Marxist theory. And thinking about sabotage and this politics of withdrawal, I've been engaging a lot with the work of activists and scholar activists who talk about the politics and epistemology of self-determination. So everyone from Kwame Nkrumah, Angela Davis, Patricia Hill Collins. And then following on that, when it comes to these citation practices that I talked about, I argue that the way we cite is similar to what Bud Hall and Rajesh Tandon in their 2017 paper on decolonizing knowledge call accumulation as dispossession, a term they credit to the work of geographer David Harvey. So in their example, just as universities stole and accumulated land by Native and Indigenous peoples to build campuses that would then dispossess them of the right to then live, earn, and learn on that land, we do the same as we race to accumulate as many citations of our own work by citing the work of great individuals that came before us, but forgetting those who inspired us in the communities we work in. So I see this as a form of resistance and refusal, in the words of Tuck and Yang, to this parsimonious language we're often forced to use. Just another small act of sabotage to the way that academies and citation habits unintentionally or intentionally silence entire populations. And when I think about this idea of known methods, I credit the work of Ignacio Martin Baro, who was an El Salvadoran Jesuit priest and psychologist. And he called on researchers to de-ideologize everyday experience by working with communities to co-construct data through routine practices. So now in our collective, we explore how Cachical Maya traditional oral traditions and storytelling, as well as their traditional ceremonies, can be integrated. But then also, I've pushed back against my own methodological socialization and asked, well, how did I collect data before I was a doctoral candidate when I was in a farming community? And so for Italians, it's often that we take a stroll. And so this is what I've been doing with Cachical Maya co-researchers, is that we often take a stroll and we talk. And they narrate their experiences and their landmarks. And in Italian, it's called fare una passeggiata. But now I think of that as one of my methods, one of my known methods that I've actually forgotten about because I've taken so many courses on research methods. So that's really how I've been thinking about these small acts of sabotage, that what if we brought in more of our own every day when we thought about method, rather than solely recognizing the easy things that we identify where we've carefully constructed ourselves through methodological training.
I'm not going to unpack that. I want to ask Sherelle to do a little bit of unpacking, actually. And thank you for that, Giovanni, because you've left us with a few things to think about. But Sherelle, I'd like you to help us think about this balance, this balance. Oftentimes, this contradiction and this tension in the academy between and picking up on some what Giovanni says, those kind of known methods that exist, and trying to engage in some methodological sabotage. He makes it sound like we should be in the farm of in the farmland, but we're not always in the farmland, but we're calling out others. So how do you think about this?
Yeah, I think, and this, your point really segues nicely to what Giovanni was talking about, to lay the groundwork. And I think, you know, I try to think about my epistemological and ontological commitments and to what and to whom my research is answerable and accountable to. Thinking about Patel's work, like specifically, I try to engage in anti-racist and decolonial research methods that center those that have been on the margins. And I try to be concerned with the lived experiences of others and how they are centered in research. I think it's easy to get focused on identifying problems to justify our research, but really we have to be careful with these Western paradigms that center deficit perspectives that focus on fixing people rather than attending to oppressive systems. With all that said, we also need to be mindful of the ways in which white logics and white supremacy is embedded within our research methods and how we must work to retool and think about our methods and who they're excluding, who they're exotifying, and how they're dehumanizing people. What assumptions, I think, is also something that we need to be looking at. We're making when we utilize certain methods. What biases do these methods possess that we need to account for and interrupt if we say we are committed to methodological sabotage? I also think that that means that we need to be slow to conduct research. So similar to what Megan was talking about, and really thinking about, why am I interested in doing this research? Should I be the one to conduct this research? What is the impact of conducting this research? Who will benefit from this research? Also thinking about how power is dispersed within this research. How will this research be disseminated, right? For example, is it published in a fancy journal, or is it available and accessible to community members? And so those are some of the things that I think about when trying to balance the commitments within the academy and the expectations, while also thinking about ways to sabotage methods and methodology.
Helpful. And thank you for the references. Let me ask you, Elizabeth, as well, to think about that as well, because I'm thinking about John Stansfield's work and some of the notions that he lifts in terms of rethinking the ethnocentric reproduction of knowledge in our social science and universities. So how is it, and how might we as academics begin to engage in some sabotage in the academy with these largely older, oppressive, patriarchal systems that have been traditional and have been driven in our Euro and American thought for hundreds of years?
Yes, definitely. Thank you for that question. And kind of when I start out and thinking about just the act of sabotage, and even just starting from that word, trying to get other academics on board with the idea of sabotage and thinking about it as a deliberate subversion to the system, that we are intentionally trying to be destructive or obstructive to the system, right? And I think that's a good point that Sherelle had mentioned, is just keeping the distinction there in mind between the difference between person to person versus looking at an institution or a system. Another way to think about sabotage is to think of it as historically, when people use the word sabotaging, like some sort of plan, or sabotaging your employer, right? As we mentioned, a way to kind of hinder the manufacturing, right, would be an example. That workers or the labor movement would get involved in. And thinking about the post-secondary education system and with the rise of neoliberalism within the system, where we as educational experts are increasingly being treated, right, like parts of this kind of machine, that where we're churning out these monocultural body of laborers, right, for the workforce, and a growing discontent that is felt by academics and educators. But it kind of with that, we also have seen a little bit of this growth of apathy as well, which I think kind of works against that, this feeling that this is the way things are going to be, right? Or the tides kind of swing back and forth and we'll just wait for things to swing back the other way. And so in other words, they're thinking still within the system rather than questioning the system and thinking about how we can start to do some of that deliberate subversion. So I feel like, especially right now, there's a lot of attention. People are paying more attention because I feel like it's always a political time, right? And there are always activists who are working and mobilizing and social movements are happening, you know, all the time. But right now, people are paying more attention. And I think to sabotage, you have to be willing to risk, right? So you have to be able to risk social, political, financial, other forms of capital. And so for many academics, I feel like that's a sticking point. That's a hurdle. And in order to get more academics involved, I think we take advantage of that, the fact that people are paying more attention now. And when people feel that motivation, maybe it's anger or frustration or around a certain issue, you do get more people on board, but it's not quite enough because people need to understand why the issue is important. And that includes understanding the long history. And as you mentioned, thinking of it in terms of an ethnocentric understanding, then we know that there's that responsibility for people to do some of that internal work and learn that history and why it matters for them personally and their responsibilities to that issue. And so knowing that history and questioning our own positions within it and within the systems, then we can continually reflect about what powers and privileges we have and doing that individual work. And I think at the same time, we start to build these relationships between peoples and between the academics within the community. Together, we can feel more confident in questioning the ideologies that are there and critiquing the institutions and the systems together. But to do that, I think we have to lay out a very clear vision of what the end result is going to look like, what we share in this vision, and to give very clear first steps that feel reasonable and doable. And then as we work together in that way, we have to understand that saying we are supporting each other is not quite enough, right? That especially right now, we hear a lot about, I'm in solidarity with you, or I'm in solidarity with your communities. But again, we have to put our capital where our mouth is. And so solidarity is this embodied practice, right? It's an embodied action and it's a relational action, right? Where we grow relationships with people in different communities. And that's from Fujikane. And so I really draw upon that idea to try to think about how to bring more people within the academic community together around these issues.
Oh, no, that's great. That's profound. Let me move to Sasha to hopefully find a way to think through that. I'm taking a lot from Elizabeth's points here, Sasha, and one of them around relevance has to do with maybe one of the things you spoke on earlier, the relevance of your work, who's this work for, and responsibilities. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your work, and the relevance of your work around your topic as well, please.
Thinking about two points that Elizabeth made, one, that the time is now, and that we need to take first steps. We need to have a few clear first steps. I do agree with those two points. I do think the time is now, and we cannot ignore the centuries of dangerous and dark histories of research, particularly with individuals in what are deemed marginalized or vulnerable populations. One of which is the community that I work with, individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Between the recent efforts of the last half of a century trying to prevent the mistreatment that was that there is riddling their past, and the socially accepted view, not my view, but the socially accepted view that these individuals will not understand the research or construct knowledge, therefore they have no interest in research or being included in the research, has resulted in no research including this group. It's lacking. In addition to that, there's not only a belief that this group won't understand, or marginalized groups won't understand, it's that there's a distrust of the data. So what they do tell us, what we do listen, what we do hear from them, we don't believe. In order to triangulate that data, we go somewhere else to trust the source. So the academy and hope, and what I'm trying to work on sabotaging is chipping away at that epistemicide. You know, D'Souza DeSantos says killing of knowledge. And particularly for the disability community, we've had centuries of killing knowledge. The research has not only been dirty and painful, it's led to silencing and truly killing of the knowledge production. It perpetuates systemic exclusion in research and continues this gap between individuals with disabilities and knowledge production. I really think that's relevant to my work, and it's particularly dangerous in the fields that I'm in, because special education and disability research tend to emerge from social sciences and social justice fields, right? And so the research that has been done may be seen as benevolent, but in fact was really harmful and contributes to the injustice and the silencing of an entire population. Additionally, to me, this work is really relevant because I, like Sherelle said, I approach this through a social construct of disability, not medical, not deficit view. Biodiversity, including neurodiversity, is natural, it's important, and it's everywhere throughout our world. The academy, the institutions, higher ed may still be an ivory tower. And I recognize that I am a tenant in that tower, and I'm rather comfortable. So how can I use my comfy position to push back what the research mold looks like? In particular for this dissertation, it's not following a traditional steps outlined in any of our qualitative textbooks. It's not hitting all the check boxes for a phenomenological study or for a participatory action study. But it is still solid work. My group doesn't fit into some sort of qualitative matrix. And I wonder, can this be okay? And I continue to answer, yes, it is okay. This is good, solid work. I am engaging in conversations and dialogue with my research community, and I am exercising Freire's trust through dialogue. These co-researchers are the experts because of their lived experiences, and I want to center the experiences as expertise instead of, well, the method wasn't followed through to a T, if that makes sense. I also enter this research with a background in explicit instruction, like training students. And a lot of these young adults have come from the school system or the community system where they were trained to sit, listen, obey, copy, blend in, do what they do, do what somebody without a disability does. And giving room and space for doing whatever you want, say what you want, don't answer the way you think it is for a test is a small act of sabotage for this particular community. But I think that can extend to other marginalized groups as well. So really, I think just knowing that I'm a privileged white woman who does not identify as having a disability, I have a lot of power in that I can shake up what the privileged white male scientists and scholars have laid out for the last hundreds of years. And I'm excited to continue working with my group beyond dissertation and hopefully lay out some new frameworks that can be used to be more inclusive.
The Qualitative Research Special Interest Group was established in 1987 to create a space within the American Educational Research Association for the discussion of ethical, philosophical, and methodological issues in qualitative research. We invite you to consider joining the Qualitative Research SIG today. For members of AERA, the annual fee for joining the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group for regular non-graduate student members is $10, and the annual fee for graduate students is $5. As members of the QRSIG, you will gain access to a network of fellow qualitative scholars, as well as our many activities, ranging from mentoring opportunities to our podcast series to updates and news related to recent qualitative publications and jobs. Please visit the American Educational Research Association's website at www.aera.net to join the Qualitative Research SIG today.
Thank you, Sasha. That's also work that seems quite important and significant. And I want to dovetail your comments and relevance and issues of responsibility and carving new spaces to Melissa. How might we fear those who critique the saboteurs? How do we respond to the status quo, or to those who say that this diversity is about deviance, or difference is really about deficit? Help us. I'm using some of the words that Edmund Gordon has written in a paper as well that I'd like to come back to with other colleagues. But help us, Melissa. What do you think?
Well, I would say that it's more important now than ever to, especially for those of us who identify as white, we have a responsibility to engage in explicitly anti-racist work now that these racist systems and structures have been revealed to us. We've had these blind spots for centuries, as Sasha has said, especially in relation to people with disabilities, that we have these movements going on right now, the racial justice movement, of course, in the context of which we wrote this paper. And then as we revised the paper and then got it accepted for publication, more and more names were being added to the list, victims of police brutality. And now we see a rise in anti-Asian hate crimes. And for me personally, my research is with refugees, and there's been a lot of contention around the issue of forced migration and refugee resettlement in the United States. And here in Turkey, where I live, there's a lot of polarization around Syrian refugees, what their rights should be, and the long-term outlook. So I really believe that this is the time that we need to stand up and push back. Actually, this idea of sabotage is that we're working from the inside to dismantle these racist systems and structures. And so what we tried to do in our paper was start with ourselves, especially for Megan and for me as white women who have these blind spots. We wanted to engage in a really structured process of reflexivity in order to kind of sensitize ourselves to how these incidents feel very different for our co-researchers of color. The particular incident that we look at in the paper seems relatively simple on the surface, a white man who works in the university in the facilities, actually he never identified himself, basically accosted Elizabeth for moving a table during this research event with youth. And then as we dug deeper, we saw how it was really racially charged, looking at it through Elizabeth's experience and through Sherelle's experience of trying to intervene and find some resolution for this incident. So I wasn't even at the event actually, but for me, it was a really important process of looking at how I'm missing the point in these types of interactions, how in my own research with refugee youth and young adults, I might be missing something that's really affecting their experience, some structural issues or interpersonal issues. So we took this approach of critical race theory and actually critical whiteness theory to examine these kind of layers through a critical race praxis from Yamamoto, where we look at the experience and rethink it and then translate it, looking at how these racist structures and patterns of white supremacy are operating in our society and in our institutions that are supposed to be safe havens for diversity. And then engagement, which is really grappling with the tensions that can happen within our research collectives, in our interpersonal relationships, and then trying to center the experiences and knowledges of these communities, marginalized communities, and working towards more equitable curricula, policies, practices. So in my own research, I'm trying to do that with refugee populations. And it's hard, but I feel that this is really our the commitment that we need to make as critical qualitative researchers to engage in hard work, because we have this privilege and we need to do more than just position ourselves as allies. We need to break down these structures from within. Those of us who have privilege have perhaps more power to work towards change.
Wow, I'm inspired. I don't know how much time we have, and I don't know how much more you all have to say, but I certainly want to thank you for your appealing to the Kujichagulia of our communities, the self-determination, and not being wedded just to the university's own understanding of knowledge and participation and relevance. Thank you for your satyagra, for your pushing that notion of understanding the pure soulness of what our work is about. Thank you as well for your parisia, for your vulnerability, for telling the truth, for not being afraid and courageous. So as I turn back to you, I couldn't help but think about some things that I'm thinking about right now. One, it's the centennial year of Professor Edmund W. Gordon, who is celebrating his 100th birthday next month at TC, Teachers College. There are 2-day series of webinars. I hope you all attend, but there's a series of activities this whole year in celebration of this giant of a man. He wrote in Red Research with other colleagues, this notion of what he called community-centric bias. And I think you all are onto something quite nice. The community-centric bias, this notion, this term he terms as this tendency to make one's community the center of the universe and the conceptual frame that constrains all thought. Like he suggests that this androcentric, culture-centric, ethnocentric chauvinism known as community-centric bias is rampant. And you all simply display that in your conversation. I don't know if you all have anything else to say, but I certainly would welcome your thoughts and some dialogue a bit back and forth, a bit more saboteur.
Well, I'll go first. I think, you know, with the work of Edmund Gordon and how he really brought forth affirmative voices in the affirmative, as opposed to always looking at the achievement gap as a deficit. But one thing that I've seen is as small acts of sabotage, and really pushing back against this idea that our community is the center of the world. This is a big thing in even Italian culture. In Roman times, Rome was caput mundi, the center of the world. And that's actually something that often comes up in Italian culture. As much as the nation has struggled, I would say there's still this idea that Italy, of course, bred the Renaissance. They had a number of other cultural and philosophical advancements, but getting into anti-fascism and neo-Marxism, there was this idea against this cultural hegemony through the work of Gramsci and really in the Italian resistance movements and the Polish resistance movements, looking back at those, they had tiny acts of sabotage, or what the Polish called small sabotage or minor sabotage. And they were things as simple as not acknowledging that you spoke German, even if you did, or giving people the wrong directions simply so they would go the wrong way. And these are also things that continue to be done in Italy, in Rome, just to mess with tourists. But I would say, even in my own work and not only my studies, but my full-time job within government, sometimes you have to not speak the same language as people and recognize that. So then it's a type of calling out and calling in to say, I choose to be different. And even though the work of sabotage is meant to be under the radar, you still have to expose yourself. And I think that's important. I think that type of authenticity in one's work comes out when you enable yourself to be present, to be visible as a saboteur.
I guess I can go next. I appreciate those examples, Giovanni, because it's even thinking about my work and what I'm interested in doing is working to cite Black women, right? And thinking about Black feminist knowledge and its contributions to the academy that's often seen as an oversight. So I think about the work of Anna Julia Cooper, who Brittany Cooper in her work kind of, in her work of Beyond Respectability draws from the work of Anna Julia Cooper as this Cooperian approach, right? So specifically thinking about that as a methodological approach that's committed to seeing the Black female body as a form of possibility and not of burden, and centering the Black female body as a means of Black social thought. So I think it's about, you know, thinking about these different approaches and who are we centering, right? And so when we move beyond a deficit approach that seeks to sabotage Western ideas around research, you know, it really exists, particularly when we think about Black feminist work, exists outside what we think of as the Western research canon. And so how are we thinking about that work to infringe upon conventional notions of social science and acknowledging the relevance and the importance of centering Black women's knowledge as legitimate? So I think when we think about these acts of sabotage, we are thinking about these ideas of resisting familiar Western paradigms that are oppressive in nature. Even thinking about scholars' work like Dr. Kristen Smith, who creates a campaign calling Cite Black Women in response to the academic canon that frequently, you know, doesn't recognize the intellectual and, contributions of Black women, right? And so I think that's something that is really important that we're considering when we're thinking about these notions of sabotage and what does that actually look like. And I appreciate, Giovanni, your connection, people, you know, that we often don't see as intellectuals. So I'm thinking about Black women or folks that were enslaved and their acts of resistance. And what does that look like? And how do we take that to the next level? Or how do we take that a step further in our own research? So I appreciate your connection, Giovanni, and just wanted to add my perspective as well.
Any final thoughts? You know, here's mine. And I'm just passing the baton. I'll tell you what it looks like, Sherelle. It looks like folk who have and can draw on a history of resistance, not others, not borrowing others' resistance songs. Like, I don't need Giovanni's farm songs, Italian farm songs. I have my own fucking songs and my own history. If you don't know yours, get yours. It's like Langston Hughes. The poem is, I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to the kitchen. When company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when the company comes. Nobody will dare say to me, eating the kitchen then. There's a poem of resistance. That's what it sounds like. Find your own resistance songs. Live your life.